Before we get into this week's episode of the OCD Chronicles, I just wanted to share a few thoughts with you. I don't really do trigger warnings on the OCD Chronicles because I don't think trigger warnings sit very well with OCD. The way that we combat our OCD is to go towards our obsessions, to live with them, and to embrace feeling uncomfortable. However, we talk about some pretty heavy stuff on this episode, principally about suicide and those moments where everything is too much and we teeter on the edge of darkness. And I think that if you're going to go into this week's episode, I think it's only fair that you know what follows from this point. I also talk more about my own experiences with everything that I've just talked about than I maybe ever have to anyone other than a psychologist or my nearest and dearest. It was quite hard to lay myself out there, and you know, if you listen to this podcast regularly, I often lay myself pretty bare. And I just want you to know that if you're feeling the things that I have felt, there is something better than what I felt. I record the OCD Chronicles sometime in advance, so sometimes it's hard to tell you what's been going on in the here and now. But on recent episodes, I've tried to drop in some news about the treatment I am currently having and how I'm feeling maybe the best I've felt on the adult side of being a teenager. And I say this because I know how hard it is to get treatment. I know how hard it is to put the things that we learn in treatment into place. I know how painful it is to do the treatment. But there is something better. You can be better. Life can be better. Also, this is the penultimate episode of season 2 of the OCD Chronicles. One more episode next week, and then I can get rid of this awful, awful, awful intro music. I am so sick of this intro music and me blathering on. So just bear with me. 2 more times into the breach, and I promise you, when season 3 starts, you will never, ever have to hear that bloody piano ever again. My name is James McMahon. I have obsessive compulsive disorder. Obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD, is a mental disorder in which the person has repeated thoughts. They're called obsessions. Or feels the need to perform routines repeatedly. They might be external or internal. They're called compulsions, to an extent that generates distress or impairs general functioning. I've had it for over 20 years. Not that I knew the name for what was happening to me during most of that time. We call OCD the doubting disorder. It's much misunderstood. Treatment is difficult to come by. Anyone tuning in from the UK will be aware of the crisis point that mental health services hit some time ago. But if you can access treatment, it can be effective. I'm on a journey. I was first diagnosed in 2008 when I was 28. I rejected the diagnosis. My flat was messy. The dirty dishes piled up in the sink. I didn't have OCD, or if I did, it didn't look like how it did on the television. 10 years later, I had what may have been a breakdown. I fought for another diagnosis. I've had some treatment now, the gold standard cognitive behavioural therapy and some ERP. That's short for exposure response prevention, a painful but effective method of desensitising OCD sufferers to their fears and obsessions. But I need more, so much more. My condition has come close to ruining my life, even taking it from me, and I'm far from recovered. Sometimes I'm not sure I ever will be, but I'm in the fight. The OCD Chronicles started life as a website, a place to share OCD stories, somewhere to celebrate bravery, cheer on other sufferers, and fight misinformation. And it's a podcast now, and it's here to do a similar thing. But I also want to chart my own story. I want to be better, so badly I want to be better. I'll introduce you to the people I meet on this journey. Mental health professionals, researchers, other sufferers. It would mean the world to me if you joined me. On this episode of the OCD Chronicles, talking to Dr. Katie Gordon. Katie is a licensed clinical psychologist who specialises in cognitive behavioural therapy, and she's done research work in the field of eating disorders. So far, so relevant to both this podcast and my own personal journey. Katie is also the co-host of a psychodrama podcast, and yet the main reason why I wanted to talk to Katie for this episode was to learn more about her new book, The Suicidal Thoughts Workbook, CBT Skills to Reduce Emotional Pain, Increase Hope, and Prevent Suicide. There's much real talk that follows from this point, but I wanted to say something before we begin. If you listen to this podcast, chances are you struggle with OCD too. I know the pain you're in, I know how hard it can be, but please, know how sincere I am when I say this. I really want you to stay. So hello, Katie. I thought a good place to start with this would be if you would tell the good listeners of this podcast who you are and what it is you do.
Sure. My name is Katie Gordon. I'm a clinical psychologist, and I currently am about half of my time doing research on disordered eating and suicidal thoughts and behavior, and the other half of my time, I'm a therapist providing therapy to people for a lot of different mental health concerns, including suicidal thoughts.
Well, I'm in the right place. Obviously, this podcast largely revolves around obsessive compulsive disorder and my experiences of that, and speaking to other sufferers and experts in that field. But one thing I really did want to cover was suicidal thoughts. So when I found out about your book, I just thought that you would be perfect to speak to. Can you tell me a bit about your book?
Absolutely. The book that I wrote is called The Suicidal Thoughts Workbook. The subtitle is Cognitive Behavioral Therapy Skills to Reduce Emotional Pain, Increase Hope, and Prevent Suicide. And the reason that this book came about is that before I was a therapist, I was actually a professor for 10 years and did a lot of research focused on suicide prevention. And then starting to move into doing more therapy, recognized that there are a ton of self-help books out there. There are a lot of workbooks, but there actually are a limited amount that specifically address suicidal thoughts, even though they're a pretty common problem to experience. And among the ones that are out there, not all of them are informed by the most up-to-date science and clinical wisdom about how to best cope with suicidal thoughts. So my goal was to make that information more accessible to people.
I think that's what jumped out at me, actually, was that, I'm very familiar with a lot of self-help material, but I don't think I'd ever seen anything that had almost declared its intentions so explicitly, if that makes sense.
Absolutely. And I was happy that my publisher viewed that the same way, is that it should be something that is very clear to people who are seeking help for suicidal thoughts, that we don't kind of make it more vague or something that's harder to see. I think that hopefully that will appeal to people and encourage direct discussion of suicidal thoughts. But I also understand that sometimes people are more drawn to self-help books that are more vague about kind of focusing on feeling good or feeling better without naming suicide specifically.
How do you feel about the term suicide? I kind of balk a little bit just because because its connotations with it being a criminal act and the history of suicide. Is that a word that you feel all right with, or am I being a bit oversensitive there?
Do you mean specifically when people use the term like commit suicide?
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely prefer a more descriptive term based on how that affects people, describing it as die by suicide or if someone kills themselves, because I think that the commit part is often associated with sin or crime, as you suggested. And so I think that suicide itself, I think using that term makes sense, but explaining in a context that's non-stigmatizing, that is non-judgmental in terms of reflecting on the person who's struggling, those are really important aspects of talking about suicide for me.
I think what you just said is exactly how I see things, actually. I think, though, it's interesting you say that thing about reducing stigma. I should say, for transparency, that I have had some episodes in the not too distant past where, out of desperation at wanting to be free of OCD, I have found myself in a place that I could maybe have been described as suicidal. I think that as I have had treatment for my OCD, I've started to realize that maybe it wasn't as simple as that. It was less wanting to not exist, and it was more just sheer desperation at wanting the obsessions and the thoughts and the rituals to stop. But I am interested because there had been a lot of talk within my nearest and dearest about suicide. That word obviously came up a lot, talking about the situation that I'd been in. And it is a word that does a lot of heavy lifting, if that makes sense. It's a word that's very frightening for people. And sometimes I found it a little bit difficult to actually talk about the emotion behind it because people are scared, you know, people are scared of that word. Does any of that make sense?
Yes, definitely. First of all, thank you for sharing that. I think doing podcasts like that and speaking openly about the struggles and pain that go along with struggling with OCD is incredibly, incredibly important, because people experience so much shame around OCD and suicidal thoughts. I also think that what you're saying is really important, that suicide is an outcome when someone dies by suicide, but that can sometimes leave out the important point that you're saying about what's driving the suicidal thoughts in the first place. And it sounds, in your experience, a lot of that wasn't about not wanting to live your life or wanting to die, but wanting to have some relief from these excruciating OCD symptoms and experiences. And I think that is true for so many people. And that's a big aim that I had with the book, which was to focus on emotional pain driving the desire for suicide and focusing on suicide prevention, but also going deeper than that about what leads up to that in the first place.
Yeah, now that's interesting. I'm going to come back to that point in a second, because I just think I should probably see through a bit where we're at. I guess the thing, I mean, are you familiar at all with OCD and those thought patterns?
Yes, OCD is one of, I do therapy with people who struggle with OCD.
Okay. So I guess what I've kind of learned is that I think that suicide for a time, for me, became a compulsion. The thoughts about suicide became a compulsion, as opposed to actually an internal compulsion, as opposed to actually being something that I wanted to do. I think that there was always something in my mind that said, well, there's always a way out. You know, like, no matter how much you're gripped by this suffering, like, you aren't bound to it because you do have an option. And I think that, consequently, when I found myself in a situation where I could have maybe been described as suicidal, I think that what had actually transpired was that I don't think it was something that I wanted to do. I think it was that almost I told myself that that was the plan if I couldn't handle these thoughts anymore. And I think that, I guess where I'm going with this is, how do you distinguish between almost those genuine thoughts of wanting to end one's life. And what I've now come to learn is suicidal ideation. How would you describe the difference between those two things to people?
So just to make sure I understand what you're saying, so you felt like suicide, thinking about it, was a comfort because it was, if it meant you weren't stuck, that you think if you didn't get relief from the OCD symptoms, that you had another way that you viewed as an escape. Is that right?
I think so, yeah. And I actually think as well, you know, I'm very connected with other sufferers of OCD. And I think that actually that's actually more common. And I'm sure with other mental illnesses and other mental health conditions as well, but I think it's more common than actually than I really knew. I don't think I'm the only person who'd been thinking that. And I think that what happened is that when it all got too much for me, that had been the plan in my head for so many years. That had always been the sort of the blueprint of how I would escape this torment, this mental torment, and therefore felt kind of not obliged is the wrong word, but like that was where I went with it when it all became too much for me. And actually, I think I found myself in a place where I went, I'm not suicidal. You know, I'm just desperate to not be thinking like this. And I think that sometimes from what I've actually kind of gathered from other people who've been in that place, that maybe it hasn't always been about wanting to end their lives. It's been about almost like suicide has become something they've almost fantasized about as an escape, if that makes sense. So I guess what I'm trying to say is, I do think there is a distinction there, you know, and when I'd heard that term suicidal ideation, that's why I kind of thought, all right, well, there is a difference.
Yes, you're definitely not alone in that. In fact, I've heard people describe that thinking about suicide, I have a section in the book actually about this, about fantasizing about suicide or daydreaming about suicide, that almost becomes a way for people to cope and feel like they can live because they feel like there is another plan. There are some, so in that case, you're certainly not alone, and people experience that. It can be concerning in terms of what you're saying, for when does that put someone at higher risk for acting on suicide? Is that what you're saying, that kind of desire that would lead to someone attempting suicide?
I think I'm just talking about the murk that lies between almost those two states of mind. And, you know, I found myself when I had my episodes, for want of a better word, it feels disrespectful to describe them as suicide attempts because I was certain I found myself in a situation where I scared a lot of people and people had to find me and I, you know, I needed help. But I think that actually what happened was that when I kind of got funneled into the, unfortunately, quite broken mental health system in the UK, I kind of found myself having to really sort of answer a lot of questions about my intentions with regards to ending my life, when actually I think I realized very quickly that I wasn't suicidal, that I was just desperate. And like I say, I think that you've almost hit the nail on the head there, talking about almost like seeing suicide as a comfort as opposed to actually something that a person wants to do. But I'm also very aware as well, I have to say, that I'm 41. I feel like and if I was older, I think this would be more so, but, you know, I was a huge fan of the band Nirvana. And when I was 14, Kurt Cobain took his life. That was almost like my first sort of encounter with suicide. Like the idea that someone could take their life was quite a stark schooling of the realities of how hard the world could be. And I actually feel a lot in my life in the following almost 30 years that there has been so many myths dispelled about suicide or new ways of thinking about it, that I'm probably in a place now where I feel like I'm not totally sure almost how it works. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes. I'm around the same age as you and was really impacted by Kurt Cobain's death. I'm a big Nirvana fan too. And I think the discussion surrounding suicide has expanded a lot since then, and that's helpful, but it also can make things, like you said, murkier or harder to understand the different levels. And scientists and therapists within who are focused in the area of suicide prevention do have certain ways to classify suicidal thoughts. But the truth is, it's just a really broad spectrum where it is sometimes more about or what would be called passive suicidal thoughts, thinking about it as wanting to escape, but not necessarily planning to act on it, versus more active thoughts where the person's actually planning and actively desiring death, usually to escape pain. And so there is a huge broad range, and trying to pinhole those things or put those things into small categories can actually be quite difficult.
Yeah, I think I went off to make a career in music, and there was a lot. I mean, there's been a lot of musicians that I knew that took their lives. And I think that with that has almost, I don't know, I feel almost sort of uniquely placed in a sense to sort of take a litmus test of changing perceptions of suicide. I will always remember a particular musician dying, and a father that I knew would talk about how selfish this person was taking their life, you know, when they had children. And I know from my own experience that that's not how suicide works. Like, you don't think like that. And also there's been, you know, there's a lot, you know, as a writer, how we talk about people taking their lives is something that we think a lot more about now, whether it's providing resources at the ends of articles, or there's things that I balk at now when, it wasn't a million years ago that like bands would almost talk about suicide as quite a glamorous thing, you know, like there has been a shift in thinking. But I guess what I'm trying to say in a very roundabout way is that what are the myths about suicide that need to be dispelled? Like, almost what's the kind of the psychological thinking about it now?
Sure. I'm glad you brought up the myth about suicide being a selfish thing. I think that that's idea is decreasing a bit over time, but it's still sometimes there. And from the perspective of someone who is feeling suicidal, what the research actually suggests is that often, and in fact, you mentioned Kurt Cobain, he says this in his suicide note, that he felt that his daughter and wife would be better off without him. And so through his perspective, which I don't think was accurate, but through the pain he was feeling, he felt like a burden and felt like the unselfish thing was to remove himself from their lives. That's very, very tragic and very sad, but it's also not coming from a selfish motive, right? It's quite the opposite. So that's one of them. I think another big one that I am seeing change around, but that people still are afraid that if they talk about suicide, they might plant it into someone's head. Or, you know, maybe if you ask kids how they're doing or talk directly to them about suicidal thoughts, or adults, that they weren't thinking about it, but all of a sudden they are thinking about it now. The research suggests that's very unlikely. And so the best practice, what does seem to be helpful, is to directly ask people and talk to people about suicidal thoughts. So that's another myth that's kind of been broken down, or so it seems. So those are two of the ones that come out. I think the third one that I might mention too is that something that the field, I think, is paying a lot of attention to now is that some conceptualizations of suicide have focused on it being an outcome of a mental illness, and maybe specifically tied with depression. And while people who struggle with mental illness and other problems do have some elevated risk, most will not go on to die by suicide. And therefore, I think there's been a broadening in looking at risk factors for suicide beyond mental illness, because it's not a precise way to predict. So people have been looking more at factors such as loss, financial insecurity, unemployment, incarceration, not having housing. And I think that that oversimplification of suicide as being a result or outcome of mental illness only has been expanded, or at least it feels trying to expand that view of what leads to suicide.
That's really interesting. I mean, I guess while we're on Kurt Cobain, the other thing that I think is that a lot of my knowledge base, I guess is what I was saying before, it was formed by what I read about Kurt Cobain and how I felt about it. But there are things that were said. Obviously, I'm a music writer, so these things are sort of, they're very, I mean, I have OCD, so therefore it's very hard to shake thoughts and memories anyway. But there are things that I thought for a long time to be true because I'd read them written around the narrative of Kurt Cobain. And one of them was that a lot of people talked about how there was suicide in the family. And the other one that people said was that almost like the signs were always there. Like both of those things are myths, right?
That there was suicide in his family specifically, or kind of that family factors can increase risk for suicide?
No, well, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I certainly can see how factors within one's family would be part of the mix. But I think what I was saying more explicitly was that people would talk about how if you went and combed through his art, you could see the sign that were to come. But also, I guess more, what I think is probably more inaccurate, and you know, correct me if I'm wrong, is that people would talk about how there was suicide in his family, almost that the propensity to kill oneself was genetic.
That's a great question. There is some evidence suggesting that there are genetic links specifically to suicide. So, for example, there is a study, which I could give you a link to put in the show notes. I haven't looked at it in a while, and I want to make sure I get the details right. But the main part of it was looking to see if there might be a specific increased risk for suicide as compared to, say, like increased risk for depression. And there did, at least in this study, if I'm recalling it correctly, that there did seem to be some specific risk related to suicide. That being said, there are a lot of people who would have suicide in their family and do not go on to die by suicide. So having some risk is a lot different than it forming destiny or fate or something like that.
Okay. That's not totally what I thought you were going to say, but that is interesting. You learn something new every day, don't you? With your book, then, is it geared towards, because obviously I should make it clear to the listeners that I've come to interviewing you and knowing about your book from a place of intrigue as opposed to having read it myself. I'm going to make sure I do that. But does it come from the perspective of the reader is having suicidal thoughts? This is the work that you would do with CBT to navigate those thoughts?
Yes, and also, if you don't mind me backtracking a little bit, I did want to respond. I realize I didn't respond to your other question about the signs always being there with Kurt Cobain. And I did just want to say that I agree with you that it's not the kind of thing that, in retrospect, we can find things and connect them, right? Like I have they published his journals and stuff like that. And we could look at that and say, oh, here were the signs and here were this and here it is in his art. I think that ahead of time, that's very difficult to predict because many more people have suicidal thoughts than attempt or die by suicide. So I agree with you that that's kind of a myth, this idea that we can precisely identify. So I just wanted to mention that because I think that's a really interesting point that you brought up about how good people are at predicting based on supposed signs.
I actually have to say that there has been in my recent past, suicide has been more of a constant with people I know than any other point in my life. And there are people who sadly aren't with us anymore that I, with hindsight, could see it coming. So I don't want to say that you can't see signs in someone, but at the same time, there are also people who it just completely It just completely blew my mind, you know, broke my heart, because the person that I saw the last time I saw them was not someone who I would ever think that about. And I think that from my own experience, I'm not sure that when my stuff happened, anyone, even those close to me, would have thought this was going to happen. So, you know, the mind is, well, that's the very point of this podcast, the mind's a complicated thing, isn't it?
That's so right. So some people, first of all, I'm sorry that you've been in contact with so many people who've struggled. I think that's incredibly painful. And you're right that there are some signs that we can all look for. If we see someone withdrawing or their mood suddenly shift, or they're certainly if they're talking about suicide, increased sleep disruption, any of those things, it's good to check in with people. And you're also right that some people, it's not clear that they were struggling. And so it's difficult to identify, but there are some signs. I think when we get to someone's art or music and picking out specific symbolic things, that is even harder than kind of the more clear warning signs that you would see with someone who's talking about or planning to kill themselves or starting to isolate themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, no, totally. I think actually as well, it's something I've had to check myself on as a writer. I mean, I write quite a lot about, I've written quite a lot about missing people. I've written quite a lot about true crime, but specifically missing people cases. And there's a lot as a writer where you're almost looking for clues and threads and, you know, what this meant when this person did this and were the signs there. But, you know, you kind of have to remind yourself, all right, I do, because I think that I'm a writer with a real conscience and wants to do the best I can. You kind of have to remind yourself that, you know, this stuff isn't Hollywood. Like, there isn't a narrative of... I just think life's more chaotic than that. But I think all those things you've just said to me about signs that you can keep an eye on with people who are close to you, I think is really spot on.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. And you're right. Writing, it's important to connect those things. And I imagine it sounds like you do that in a balanced way, right? It's more interesting to write about those issues, tying together pieces. I think the thing that I worry about with suicide is if people blame themselves because they miss some subtle cue or something like that. We should all look for warning signs and try to check in with our friends, but we also can miss things, and it's not always obvious. So I think that kind of balance is important, because I know when people lose someone to suicide, often it's like, well, I should have seen this or I should have known that. And so it's this kind of situation where we do what we can, we look for those signs and we connect with people when we can, but we also recognize that we can't read minds.
So I was asking you about your book, but before mm-hmm. before you answer that, there's probably something which is more relevant to ask you now. When I had my stuff, I had a bunch of people who reached out to me, and all of them I'm hugely grateful for. I think it was all very sincere and with a lot of love. But you know, you don't learn how to converse with suicidal people. I mean, you don't learn that anywhere. You know, you do your best. And there were a lot of things that were said to me that I didn't find hugely helpful. But I'm not judging anyone, because, like I say, there's not a manual, there's not a guidebook to this stuff. But one of the things that would be said was, you know, think about how your family would feel. And I found that one quite difficult, because I suppose that was probably the point, really, was to actually sort of like break the cycle I was in, you know, make me think of something else. But it at the same time, it felt like it didn't really capture the place I was in. What do people say to people who they think are suicidal? Like, what is the best thing they can do to help?
I'm glad you highlighted that, because I think that from the person who is worried about their friend dying by suicide, it makes sense to them to try to point out things like that. Well, how would your family feel? But for people who are struggling, that can feel, it can feel invalidating. Like, it's kind of saying, think about other people's feelings rather than focusing on the person who's struggling's feelings. It can also bring more shame and guilt to someone who's already struggling. So with the general idea that different things certainly work for different people, the biggest thing that I recommend is non-judgmentally listening to what the sources of the pain are before trying to argue against it, before trying to problem solve. If the person is immediately at harm, like, you know, they're talking about they're going to kill themselves and they have those, the means to do so, then yes, you have to act quickly. But if that's not the situation, if they're having some of the thoughts and they're sharing that with you, the goal is to make it so that they're comfortable opening up more. And that can mean sitting with their own anxiety and discomfort. So really, I think open questions, you know, how does that feel? That sounds so hard. I could imagine if I were in your position, I might feel the same way. Those things, I think, tend to open up the conversation more so that the person can feel like, hey, I can really talk about this. I'm not being, I don't have to manage the other person's feelings. So that's what I generally recommend. But I also think it's okay to directly ask what would be most helpful for you right now. And that way you can hear, okay, it may be just sitting with you, or maybe you do want me to problem solve, and that can be helpful too.
Oh, that's a good one, isn't it? Yeah, now that is, that's very good. I have to say, I mean, he won't be listening to this because he has much better things to do, but my brother was unbelievable when I found myself in that place, and almost feels a little bit like, when I think about it now, it almost feels like a little bit of a risky strategy, but he reached out to me when I was in the middle of nowhere and really teetering. And he made me laugh. Like, he was, I mean, my brother is the funniest man I've ever met. And he just was so, it was impossible to, it was like a circuit breaker, you know? It was like, once I was laughing, then I started to think, why am I here in the middle of nowhere? Like, I need to stop this. You know, I need to go get a cup of tea and get warm. And it was quite remarkable, you know. But sadly, not everyone has a brother like mine, you know. Yeah. So tell me about the book. Tell me about the sort of the meat and potatoes of it. Like, so is this almost like a workbook for navigating these feelings, for changing the way that you think about them?
It is, and I also, as a therapist, I know I don't always have to reflect what you say, but I just want to briefly say, I think that's wonderful. And that humor.
I'm trying to promote your book here, Katie.
But I will also just quickly say, I think that's great that your brother was helpful. And I do think humor can have a way of changing perspective. So now my book,
which I'll talk about. Let's do it.
Is that something
that therapists are taught, by the way? Like, you know, I have a therapist. She's great. I got interviewed. I'll rep this podcast, but I got interviewed by a podcast called Sound Effects, which talks to people who work within music about mental health. And I did an episode about my OCD. And the woman who does that podcast is someone I've sort of known on and off for years, and a lovely person, but works as a therapist. And I did find that every time I said something that was, you know, maybe implied a degree of suffering, there was like a, I just want to check in with you. Is that something that therapists learn at therapy school?
It is. We kind of feel bad leaving things hanging. We want to notice emotions and processes that are going on with people and make sure the person knows that we're paying attention. And so it is something that we learn in school to do, and it becomes a habit.
No, it's good. It's good. It's not criticism at all. It's just me trying to understand more. Right, here we go, the book.
Yes, the book. So the book is, the goal of the book, I had kind of two things in mind. One, and most importantly to me, is that if someone's struggling with suicidal thoughts, and either because of the system having obstacles for them to get help, or they're on a wait list, or because they themselves want to seek out self-help before seeking out therapy, that they could have what the science and clinical world says are the best things for them. So I actually designed it as I would a therapy process, walking the person through creating a crisis plan for when they are having suicidal thoughts, finding ways to reduce emotional pain, increase hope, strengthen relationships, and make meaning, and other tools like that. And so I tried to make it conversational as much as I could. I hadn't written something like this before, but tried to make it check in with the person, as we talked about, give a lot of examples. And the idea, hopefully, is that the person will feel empowered to do that. And then the second audience I thought of was therapists, because the more therapists that are capable at working with people with suicidal thoughts and helping them, the better it is. And so the secondary thing was thinking for therapists to have this to share with their clients as exercises to work through and gain skills through.
Thanks so much for making that book. Like I say, I haven't read it yet, but it just really sounds like something that should exist that I don't think does exist beyond your book.
Thank you. And I'd be happy to send you a copy too. I appreciate the opportunity to talk about it. One thing that might be of interest with the focus on OCD that I thought I'd mention, I do mention this in my book, is that there are sometimes people who really don't want to die by suicide, but they can have intrusive obsessions that they're going to kill themselves. And then they can have compulsions that involve not being around knives or other things like that.
Yeah.
And I view that as kind of different as these types of suicidal thoughts. There are books specifically out there and resources for people who have OCD with fear of harming themselves. But I think my book it's not as helpful for that. There are resources listed in there for that particular thing, because as you know, struggling with OCD, if there really aren't the suicidal desire there, it could be unhelpful to them work through it as a suicidal thoughts workbook. However, if someone has OCD and is struggling with suicidal thoughts, then I do think it hopefully will be a helpful tool for you.
I think you actually just summed up in a far more articulate way than I did right at the beginning of our conversation, is that I was trying to make that distinction really. I think it took a while for my nearest and dearest to sort of twig this as well, who are actually, because they've been on a very long journey with me in OCD, they're actually pretty good at, or very, very good at understanding the complexity of OCD. And I think that once they'd sort of realised that, it's that thing with OCD where it's like you need to not give importance and gravitas to the nature of intrusive thoughts. Like, it isn't about the content, it's about the fact they're intrusive thoughts, and they could be about anything that is distressing. And I think that almost like what you're saying, the danger of that is that if you are having thoughts about suicide, are you actually having thoughts about suicide, or are they just intrusive thoughts? And if you then went and dealt with those intrusive thoughts like you would do a genuine desire to hurt yourself or to take your life, that is not good for the treatment of OCD.
Exactly right, because if you're right, you're engaging the intrusive thoughts if they are meaningless. They're really just, and those thoughts can be very distressing and very painful. But what I would hope is the appropriate kind of treatment that helps to step back from it, not feel as distressed by them, because they're not indicating real threat of harm by suicide, versus if someone does have the desire to die by suicide, then that's a different pathway.
Yeah, no,
of treatment.
Exactly it. I'm saying this more for the benefit of the listeners than you here, Katie, but I had a thing of, as I've talked about a lot on this podcast, I didn't get the right treatment for OCD until after my episodes. It's what kind of led me to that place. I'd been diagnosed long before that, and because of a misunderstanding of what OCD was, like, I didn't accept it, and went and treated my intrusive thoughts like, I don't know, like they weren't intrusive thoughts. You know, I spent hours and hours and hours and hours and thousands of pounds talking about them extensively with, you know, psychologists and so on. And consequently, the intrusive thoughts that I have from those times, I still struggle with a lot. But the intrusive thoughts that I have post the correct treatment for OCD, you know, CBT and exposures, I can pretty much brush off now. You know, I can have a thought about, for example, harm, and I can go, oh, stupid OCD, you know, just having a go, but I'm not going to let it in. But the things that have been embedded from years ago that I've talked about extensively with people and tried to understand where they come from and so on, they're still things I struggle with. So I do think that for the benefit of anyone listening, it is important to try and ask yourself, is this OCD or is this really where my head's at, you know? But of course, as we know, when you're in that place, it's very hard to think rationally anyway.
That's 100% true, and I'm so glad that you found the cognitive behavioral therapy and exposure helpful, because you're so right that if it's not identified as intrusive thoughts, you can end up being counterproductive unintentionally. Not you personally. I mean, the professionals hopefully can dig into that and identify it better. But I am happy to hear that you've been able to connect with an effective therapist and get some relief.
You know, I think OCD is horrendous. And my life has, you know, in various times been decimated by it. But I do think that the treatment is effective. You know, I do think that's almost the silver lining. I just think that and it's one of the reasons why this podcast exists. The real problem is access to it. I always kind of think 19 was my sort of first real serious episode with OCD. And I think if I'd understood what it was then, as opposed to being 28 or 37 or whatever it was, I think I would have saved myself a lot of suffering. But you can't look back, can you? You know, got to look to the future.
That's so true. But that feeling of those moments of sadness of having had the help earlier certainly can be painful, but you're right. It's good to know at least you got the help, the effective help when you did. And you're so right about access. That's a huge issue in the US too, of course.
Yeah, no, totally. Totally. It's the world isn't built like it should be, but you know, got to keep fighting. Tell me about your podcast.
Sure. The podcast is called Psychodrama, and that is focused on controversies in clinical practice, psychological science, and kind of societal issues. My friend from graduate school, Leonardo Bobadilla, is my co-host, and sometimes we get busy and have a hard time putting out episodes as frequently as we'd like, but we are actually going to check in today to put up some new episodes. But we really, same kind of goal actually as the book, which is to take psychological science and mental health information and make it more accessible to reach more people.
I haven't listened to it yet, but I'm going to do that shortly, but I will put that in the show notes as well. The other thing I meant to say before we call it a day is that I, last year, got diagnosed with an eating disorder. And I know that's something that you've done a lot of work on. And I wondered, I do another podcast called Shame, which is basically about the emotion that is shame. I've interviewed people who've been shamed, like publicly shamed on the internet. And I've interviewed people who things have happened to them in their lives that they have lived with shame, and interviewed people who have done the shaming. It's sort of very, the subject matter is very broad, because I think that shame, you know, affects us in so many different ways. Would you come and have a natter with me about eating disorders at some point?
Absolutely. That is such a great podcast topic. I think shame has not had enough attention as related to eating disorders and all kinds of mental health. I would be happy to do that.
Oh no, that would be brilliant. You know, Well, we'll do that. We'll do that in the future because it's Friday night here. It's 10 o'clock. What time is it? What time is it there?
It's 4 p.m. on Friday. So getting close to the end of the workday here.
Well, this is it, you know. So you're getting, are you doing anything fun tonight?
You know, unfortunately, due to the COVID rates, not a ton of big plans, but maybe just relaxing, watch a movie. So that'll be good enough for me. What about you? Are you going out and doing anything fun?
Well, no, I'm not going out, no. But I am thinking, maybe 10 o'clock to maybe 10 p.m. is the cutoff point for suicide chat, and maybe I should go watch Cool Runnings or something like that, just to put me in a place, you know.
That sounds like a nice plan. I like it.
Thanks so much for the conversation, Katie. It's been fantastic. And thanks again for putting this book into the world.
Oh, you're very welcome. Thanks for the opportunity to come on your podcast. I really appreciate what you do.
The OCD Chronicles is brought to you by sufferers of OCD, not mental health professionals. This is a place to educate and inform from a perspective of lived experience, but not to advise. Thankfully, the United Kingdom is lucky enough to have two great charities for OCD and their related disorders. One is called OCD UK, the other OCD Action. I personally found them hugely helpful in my long and storied journey with this wretched disorder. You can find them easily enough online. Solidarity with sufferers. OCD is hell, but there is hope. The OCD Chronicles is brought to you by James McMahon. That's me. It's a Spook Media production. Oh, and if you wanted to rate, review and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you listen to it on, it'd mean a lot. It's so useful in getting the podcast in front of other people. Until next time.
Hey, Coach.
Yeah?
I have to ask you a question.
Sure.
But you don't have to answer if you don't want to. I mean, I want you to, but if you can't, I understand.
You want to know why I cheated, right?
Yes, I do.
That's a fair question. It's quite simple, really. I had to win. You see, Therese, I'd made winning my whole life. And when you make winning your whole life, you have to keep on winning, no matter what. You understand that?
No, I don't understand, Coach. You had 2 gold medals. You had it all.
Therese, a gold medal is a wonderful thing. But if you're not enough without it, you'll never be enough with it.